Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Eric Mack, who is currently in the Department of Philosophy. And I also wanted me to note that he was also connected with the Murphy Institute of Political Economy at Tulane University in Louisiana. He's published articles on political philosophy, philosophy of law, and ethics in many leading journals. He's written what I think is a very provocative paper on the psychology of the commodification process as it relates to the problem of welfare.
As in effect the libertarian representative, maybe not perhaps the most pure libertarian representative on this panel today, the most natural, most easy, and most tedious thing for me to do would be to rehearse the libertarian case against state-enforced coercive redistribution, and to repeat the often noticed point that opposition to forced charity is perfectly consistent with an acceptance and even celebration of private philanthropy. Instead of engaging in that well-known and perhaps not well-known enough critique, I want to focus more on questions of moral psychology than on political philosophy. I want to address the issue of whether something about a social order in which market relationships are central to most people's lives psychologically undercuts the perceptions, impulses, and ties that feed voluntary philanthropy and feed what we might call community. While it is obvious that the market order and the ideologies that justify it are logically consistent with the promotion of voluntary charity, there are serious questions about whether life within a market order and under the sway of market-justifying ideologies is psychologically consistent with the non-egotistic concerns and patterns of behavior involved in friendship, generosity, and charity. The political relevance of this is that if it is believed that the market order disrupts our natural charitable impulses, there'll be no shortage of people prepared to argue that what appears to be the coercive fist of the welfare state is really the helping hand of society, assisting us in the coordinated reestablishment of the giving behavior which the market so cruelly suppresses. As with all important issues, this is an issue which David Hume discussed gracefully. For Hume, the primary question of social theory was how beings characterized by what he called selfishness and limited generosity could live together in a world of scarcity. Hume rejects all attempts to deal with this problem by the creation of a new mold for the human mind and by trying to radically change human character. Rather, he thought what are needed are social rules that direct our natural passions in oblique and artificial manner, so that each of us will find, in general, our own advantage through providing services to others. And then the typical Humean passage, which you would normally also find in Smith, hence, says Hume, I learn to do a service to another without bearing him any real kindness, because I foresee that he will return my service in expectation of another of the same kind and in order to maintain the same correspondence of good offices with me and with others. But might not this system be corrosive of whatever finer impulses there are among our natural passions? Hume optimistically gives a negative answer. He begins cautiously by saying, but though this self-interested commerce of men begins to take place and to predominate in society, it does not entirely abolish the more generous and noble intercourse of friendship and good offices. And then, apparently losing the caution, Hume goes further to assert that there would be actually no diminution in the degree of noble intercourse. We may still, he says, do services to others, to such persons. I may still do services to such persons as I love and am more particularly acquainted with. without any prospect of advantage, and they may make me a return in the same manner. But does the growth and predominance of self-interested commerce leave in place the more generous and noble intercourse of friendship and good offices that was reflective of our natural, although limited, benevolence? Both traditionalist and revolutionary critics of the market order have, contrary to you, answered this question in the negative. They have often agreed about the corrupting, alienating, atomizing effect of the cash nexus. I want to sketch briefly aspects of these anti-market concerns. I hope to indicate that they rest on the belief that people at large have a strong tendency to adopt what are, in fact, overly simplistic moral outlooks and moral psychologies. These overly simplistic outlooks and psychologies can be grouped under the rubric consequentialist. A consequentialist morality maintains that only results, especially results as abstractly and impersonally conceived and measured, for instance, so-and-so number of units of pleasure or such-and-such an increase in utility. The consequentialist morality says that only such abstractly conceived results are valuable in themselves. Thus, the value of any specific action or relation or disposition is purely instrumental and derives entirely from the value of its abstractly conceived result. Similarly, talking now about a consequentialist psychology, not a consequentialist morality, the source of all motivation in a person with a consequentialist psychology is the value that person attaches to certain abstractly conceived results. Motivation for specific actions or relations or dispositions is present in such a psychology only insofar as those actions are perceived as advancing some further external result, an increase in the general utility, an increase in the total number of units of pleasure in society. My contention is that consequentialism, so understood, is so false to ordinary human experience that only those supremely lacking in ordinary human experience, academic philosophers and economists being the obvious examples, can either believe it or believe that people at large are highly susceptible to adopting a consequentialist outlook or psychology. The evident falsity of consequentialism is my main reason for doubting that within the market order, folks at large will readily be reduced to consequentialist mentalities. But perhaps not life in the market order, but rather a foolish regard for philosophers and economists who do propound consequentialism will have this alienating effect. Since pro-free market philosophers and especially economists often do propound what I've called consequentialism, they may be guilty of a type of moral and psychological corruption of people at large, which mistakenly gets blamed on the market order itself. The market order which, ironically, those philosophers and economists seek to defend. Now, there are, even in relatively liberal societies, and I use the word liberal honorifically here, be the only time during this movie, there are within such societies many realms of human activity, the commercialization of which, at least officially, are forbidden. For better or worse, the existence of markets for sex, babies, bodily parts is generally prohibited. One rationale, an increasingly prominent rationale, at least in academic literature, for such prohibitions is said to be the protection of the non-market versions of these prohibited activities. For instance, the protection of sexual relationships that are engaged in for their own inherent values as opposed to commercial sex, or the protection of child appropriation and raising that's done for its own inherent rewards as against people engaging in having children for the sake of side payment. The most extensive discussion of this issue of the alternative evaluation of market versus non-market versions of a certain form of human activity has been carried on, and this brings us back to human charity, in terms of blood donation and the prohibition of a market in blood, or the arguments for that. In his book, The Gift Relationship, the British sociologist Richard Titmuss argues, socialist sociologist, argues in effect that if one looks at the provision of blood, one sees that Hume was wrong to think that the introduction of self-interested commerce would leave the more noble and generous intercourse of people intact. What Titmuss noticed was that in England, where the sale of blood was forbidden, there was no shortage of blood. Pure giving of blood sufficed to provide as much and as good blood as was needed. In the United States, in contrast, where the sale of blood was allowed, where a market for blood was permitted, there was a chronic shortage of blood. But how, in effect, he asked, could adding a market for blood to a voluntary system of donation decrease the amount of blood provided? We're assuming that no other variables matter, right? Surely, and this was the argument of Hume and of any bourgeois economist, and only bourgeois economists are real economists, they would argue that those who are moved by natural feelings of generosity and charity will continue their pure blood donation, while others will now, that a market is present, be moved to provide blood for a price. Hence, the argument goes, the total supply should increase with the addition of a commercial market. Yet, seemingly, it didn't, or doesn't. Titmuss proposed an intriguing explanation. Many potential donors, pure donors of blood, were discouraged, he thought, from giving blood by the presence of a market for blood. See, a case in which the introduction of self-interested commerce undercuts, supposedly, a more noble form of relationship between people. But Titmuss surmised the existence of a market for blood made blood into, you all know the word that's coming, a commodity. Something with a specific dollar value, hence the nature of blood donation was itself transformed, he thought, in the eyes of many potential pure donors. Rather than directly entering into a life-saving relationship, rather than providing a recipient, and in the British case, a recipient, in fact, who didn't know who you were, with something that was literally priceless, the non-commercial donor was now, in the presence of the market, simply saving the blood recipient, or worse yet, the blood recipient's insurance company, the market price of the blood that was received. By changing people's perception of the pre-commercial charitable provision of blood, the appearance of commerce in blood does, according to Titmuss, tend to abolish the more noble and generous non-market intercourse in blood. The grand generalization of this hypothesis is that, I'm speeding up, the more areas of life and forms of human interchange that are open to the commerce, the greater the extent to which people will perceive non-commercial actions and relations as merely free of charge surrogates for commercial actions. Note that on Titmuss's analysis, what motivates the donor is the felt value of personally engaging in some concrete instance of helpful behavior, not the impersonal convictions that this particular behavior advances the moral score of the world and is an efficient way of doing that. It is because people do not have impersonal and bloodlessly abstract motivations that, according to Titmuss, the anticipated loss of their personal
and concrete charitable motives is supposed to leave them unmotivated.
Let me skip a couple of nevertheless essential paragraphs.
What I want to do is just ask people to, in effect, think about their own moral psychologies and see how plausible the Titmus account is. We've each probably had the experience of a friend going to the hospital, and we're told by some third friend that our friend has lost a lot of blood and has had a transfusion. And typically the way we react in these cases is we go to the blood donation unit of the hospital and we do something we ordinarily would think would be awful, have people stick things in our arms and we give blood to our friend. And I'm even thinking of the case where you don't then announce to the world, right, that you've done this, you tend to do this anonymously. We think of such acts as personal responses in a way that's highly specific and highly responsive to what our friend has undergone. And we think that through such acts we express concern for what our friend has undergone and reaffirm our relationship of friendship. We think this way, even though we all know on reflection that our blood does not go to our friend, unless it's a special type. And on further reflection, we may realize that the only real effect of our going to the blood donation unit is, in fact, to save our friend the price of the blood, or to save his insurance company the price of the blood. But we, of course, would never conceive of simply writing a check to our friend, right? Or writing a check, again, worse yet, to his insurance company. But why, right? Why don't we do that? The reason is that we are not merely concerned about results. One doesn't merely value, or even primarily value, it's being true that some person has received a certain amount of blood or not had his wealth diminished by a certain degree. Rather, what one values is responding to a friend's condition in a way which, at least symbolically, is specific to what the friend has undergone and to what the friend needs. It's being a friend and being responsive as a friend that one values and that leads to one's actions. We value and should value ways of acting and types of relations and dispositions to act in those ways rather than just mere results. And most people, of course, realize this in their own lives. I skipped a couple of good puns. In effect, I've highlighted a paradox within Titmus's thesis. If personal acts of friendship and generosity and charity and the dispositions they express are such evidently valuable components of our lives, and I believe that, why believe that people at large will be blind to such values and will become unable to achieve them? The Titmus resolution of the paradox must be that something else in or associated with the market order does blind people to the values that attach not to abstract results, but to highly particular acts and relations. The most natural candidate for the something which might blind people is the consequentialist conception of value and rationality. I won't repeat or remind you of that. What that conception is. Time, unfortunately, also does not permit an account of the ways and the extent to which both philosophic and economic defenders of the market have committed consequentialism, or of the ways in which this charge may be unfair to sophisticated theorists. Nor is it possible to assess the extent to which the representation of all human activity or all rational human activity as economizing, as the adoption of the most efficient means for abstractly conceived, endogenously given ends, or the attempt to interpret all human actions as exchanges carried out for the sake of external rewards, to what extent all of that has, in fact, turned people away from a recognition of the sort of particular values that are important in life. What can plausibly be claimed is that this false simplification of what is valuable and what has rational motivational force
points away from an important component in the moral case for a free and significantly market-oriented society. What it points away from is the vast diversity of particular, highly personal, and hence incommensurable values, commitments, and ties that do and should motivate people. There is an irreducible diversity of values worthy and capable of inspiring pursuit, diversity across the sorts of things that are valuable, ends, actions, relations, dispositions, diversity among valuable ends and among valuable actions, and a diversity concerning for whom, which specific end, action, or relation is valuable. To recognize this ineliminable value pluralism is not to succumb to moral or psychological subjectivism. It is to recognize, rather, as nonsensical, the calls for the collective promotion of impersonal value, for instance, the calls for the collective promotion of the general utility, whatever that might be, which almost always proceed on to demands that individual liberty and individual responsibility be restricted. So what I'm suggesting is that a more perceptive moral philosophy and psychology can kill two birds with one stone. By emphasizing the particularistic richness of moral life, it can remind us of why people should not and need not become crudely conceived utility or profit maximizers, and why then they may continue to relate to others in non-calculating forms of generosity and benevolence. And the same emphasis on individual-centered and conditioned character of value can remind us of the emptiness of the abstract formulas for our collective improvement of mankind, the belief in which so often leads to encroachments on individuals and on their value-seeking freedoms.